This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our conversation with Rabbi Burton Vizatsky. Several years ago, he began a series of study groups on Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Those seminars are the basis of Bill Moyer's current PBS series on Genesis. In fact, now you can see Vizatsky participating in Moyer's series. Rabbi Vizatsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan and the author of the new book, The Genesis of Ethics. What do you think of as your job description as a rabbi now?
Well, I have to qualify it a little because I'm not a congregational rabbi. I'm an academic. I'm a professor.
Right.
I teach graduate students and I teach rabbinical students. I would say my job is to study Torah, to read the Bible and its commentaries, and then to teach it, to teach the value of ongoing community, and to try and find ways for people to realize that morals and ethics are important in their lives, even if we're not always perfectly moral and ethical, and I certainly would say I'm not perfect by any means. Nevertheless, we have to struggle to find a way, and while we're at it, it doesn't hurt to find God in our lives.
Since you don't have a congregation, you're a professor, you don't have congregants coming to you asking for advice, and I'm sure a lot of your students come to you asking for advice on their studies. But do your students come to you ever asking for advice on their private lives, on the ethical decisions they have to make
always.
In their private lives?
For the last 5 years, I just kind of retired. I was the associate dean of the graduate school at the seminary, and one of the things I loved about that job was that I did a lot of student advisement. And yes, obviously, a lot of it was academic. How do I get out of this class or take an incomplete for this class? But a lot of it was boyfriend problems, parent problems, religious problems. One woman came to me who had just had a baby and whose father was dying, and she was just utterly stressed out, but sandwiched between the two, and I immediately had sympathy since both of my parents are now gone. I remember what it was like to have parents on their deathbed with small children in the house. And this woman just wanted to drop out of her doctoral program. And I took her sternly in hand and said, no, you can't drop out of your doctoral program, but what you need to do is cut classes for 2 weeks and just go to the museum, go to a movie, give yourself some time. And she survived quite happily because she realized that she had some permission to treat herself well in the midst of trying to treat everyone else in the world well. So sometimes I think that I have the best job in the world. Actually, most of the time I think that because I get to study and teach and be with people all the time.
In a world where there are so many therapists of every sort, do you feel that the rabbis should still be therapists in a way? Rabbis were doing that work before we had the word therapist.
Well, I think rabbis and therapists have somewhat different tasks. I certainly think it is the job of a rabbi or any clergy person to help other people. But therapists can do things I can't, and I can do things that therapists can't, and I think that's as it should be. I don't think any clergy should mistake themselves for someone in the therapeutic profession. Those people are trained differently than we are.
What are some of the differences?
Well, clergy are trained to transmit religious tradition. Now, often that religious tradition speaks to deep human problems, but we are trained to transmit tradition, whereas therapists tend to be much more accepting, much less judgmental. My example in kind would be if someone came to me burdened with having committed adultery, and sometimes I've had that kind of episode, and it's clear to me that what they want is absolution, they might be able to get absolution from a therapist much more readily than they will from their rabbi. So that's a big difference. The therapist may say, that's okay, whatever you do is okay. A rabbi may say, well, if you feel really strongly about this, you might want to think about whether you really need to keep your family together. And if you need to keep your family together, you might not want to consider adultery. Those are very radically different answers to the same circumstance. And I think people need to consider very carefully who they're going to, whether they go to their rabbi or to their therapist, for whatever problems are burdening them and what kind of answers they're looking for.
Well, when somebody comes to you with a question, for instance, about adultery, what might you tell them about consequences?
Well, you just in asking the question, give the answer. Everything has consequences. There are lots of people involved, and that you always have to think about the consequences of your actions. That's what it means to be an adult, Terry, is that you know that you can't do things without consequences. So your question is the answer. What do you think about consequences? Once you've raised that question to a person, then they start thinking about consequences, they might behave a little differently.
What about like the notion of sin? Where does that figure into in the Jewish tradition?
Well, sin certainly figures strongly in the Jewish tradition. There's no sense denying that. There are lots of things that are labeled in the Bible very explicitly as sins. I say that, and as I say it, I'm thinking that more often than not, those sins that are labeled in the Bible also have a very explicit prescription for how to atone for those sins, and that is blood sacrifice. Well, we don't do blood sacrifice anymore, which may tell us that the very definition of sin has changed. But in any case, there are an awful lot of sins that people still do that are considered a sin. I remember once having a conversation with Ivan Boesky, of all people, and Ivan said to me that he felt that he had paid his price for his crimes, that he had, you know, paid his fines and gone to jail, but that he still wasn't sure what to do about his sin. And I was so startled that he was talking about sin that I asked him, well, what do you mean by sin? And he said to me, well, I've been thinking about this a long time, and I think that in addition to having done what I did that the government prosecuted me for, I really committed a terrible sin. And that was that I used people as the means to the next transaction. And once he said that, I asked him whether I could quote him on that, because I think that's about as good a late 20th century definition of sin as we could want, to use people as the means to the next transaction. Because in order to do that, you have to forget somehow that they are another person, that they have a life, that they are also in the image of God. And if we could only learn to listen to other people, truly listen to them and get past our own selves to really see them as an other person, then we've come a long way on the sin scale and learn to perhaps do some good in the world and build community.
My guest is Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, author of the new book, The Genesis of Ethics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, his seminars on the first book of the Bible inspired Bill Moyer's current PBS series on Genesis. You are the founding rabbi of the Egalitarian Worship Service at the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Yes, that's something I'm very proud of.
Tell me what the Egalitarian Worship Service was and why you thought there was a need for it.
Well, the Jewish Theological Seminary has been around for 110 years now, and only for the last 10 or so of those years have we been ordaining women rabbis. For the first century, it was, although it was a middle of the road, it wasn't Orthodox, it wasn't Reform. The synagogue at the seminary was, in fact, an Orthodox synagogue. Men and women sat separately. Men ran the service. Men got called up to the Torah, and women were, at best, observers. When we started ordaining women, we realized we had to redress that problem in some very profound way. And we decided that since we're a pluralist institution, we would now have two synagogues in the seminary. One, the old-fashioned way, and a new one, which was egalitarian. What that meant was that men and women would be treated equally in the synagogue. Women could lead services, women could read from the Torah, and I was proud to be the first rabbi to institute that part of the seminary synagogue.
Was there any resistance to it within the seminary?
There's resistance to all change. There were a lot of people who thought that the ordination of women was the worst thing we could possibly do. There were a lot of people who thought that if we instituted an egalitarian worship service, no one would come. There were equal numbers of people who thought that if we instituted an egalitarian worship service, it would take everybody away from the old style service. The fact of the matter is, to this day, both services are alive and well, and people pray as they see fit under one roof.
Now, how do you justify change to people who really believe that religion is about continuity? It's about a connection to the past. We don't make radical changes. That's not what religion is about.
Well, people do change, and society changes, and our relationship to God changes accordingly. I think you're right that there is continuity to the past. That is what religion's about. And there is, I think, an innate conservatism in a large part of religious practice. We want to do what our ancestors have done. At the same time, if we are utterly static, if we never change, religion dies. It dies without any growth whatsoever. In order for us to speak to the needs of the late 20th century, there have to be some kind of changes. They have to be considered slowly and carefully and in light of tradition, but changes are necessary. People do change, and I'll speak only about my own tradition, Judaism. Judaism has always learned to speak to the current condition of the people as they try to observe the traditional means of things. So there's a lot of tension. There's push-pull there.
When did you realize that you wanted to see a more egalitarian synagogue?
I can almost clock the moment. I used to pray in a synagogue that was very old world. Ironically, it's now in the middle of Harlem, but Harlem was once a vibrant Jewish neighborhood. And I still used to go there, and the rabbi was an old Polish rabbi who still preached in Yiddish. Even when he preached in English, it sounded like he was preaching in Yiddish. So, you know, it had all the flavor of the authentic article. And there was a men's section where men ran the service, so it was very old world. And then there was a women's section. And many years ago, I was almost dragged into the women's section after services. And I realized that I really couldn't see what was going on. And I realized that all of the women who sat up there had been virtually set apart from synagogue life simply by the fact that they were women. And that was the last time I went to that synagogue.
Who dragged you to the women's section?
A woman friend of mine who enjoyed the service but was herself going through this terrible struggle about how can you connect with this and at the same time feel so utterly excluded. This was a woman who was fluent in the ways of Jewish tradition, who lived a traditional Jewish life, who studied the Talmud, and yet could not bear to find herself a second-class citizen.
Would you ever have gone up to the rabbi at the synagogue in Harlem and said, look, rabbi, you have to understand things have changed, and how could you imagine that women would be comfortable with this type of segregation and second-class status?
Well, I did feel I owed him an explanation why I stopped coming to the synagogue, and for better or for worse, he was able, I think, to understand that on my own terms, I couldn't stay there any longer. But he was an old man. He had been a rabbi in Poland before the Nazis invaded, and I wasn't fool enough to think that he would change his ways or see the light. Furthermore, I'm not even sure that it was necessary to dissuade him. What worked for him in his community didn't work for me in my community. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't have a right to do it his way.
I have a question for you. You obviously welcome a certain multicultural approach to interpreting the Bible. You like to have Bible study groups that have people, that often have people of different faiths in them. So you're hearing the Bible from different Christian points of view, Muslim points of view, as well as Jewish points of view. And yet I know that intermarriage is a really big and controversial issue within a lot of the Jewish community. Will intermarriage be the downfall of Judaism? Will people intermarry so much that there won't be any Jewish people left? So given that you kind of embrace multiculturalism, where do you stand on intermarriage? And do you worry that, you know, if Jews don't just keep to themselves, that the religion will die out?
Well, let me almost duck the question by telling you, first and foremost, I'm not a congregational rabbi, so it's not so much a worry in my life. But as an academic, I must tell you that Jewish studies are now utterly vibrant. There have never been so many Jews doing Jewish studies at any point in Jewish history. I think the Jewish community is more vibrant now than it was 25, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. In light of that, I don't worry so much about intermarriage. You're right. I think that multiculturalism helps us intellectually learn new things. I mean, what's the point of studying with people who all think the same answer that you have? The point of study is to get a diversity of viewpoints, to sharpen your thinking, to challenge your thinking. And that's why I like not only interreligious dialogue, but even among Jews. I like studying with Reform Jews. I like studying with Orthodox Jews. I've even learned of late to study with Hasidim and study mysticism. The more the better, because we have broad-ranging intellects that need to be fed. Whether that translates into tranquility in home life is another story. And for couples who want to be intermarried, I think they have to know in advance that they're going to have a difficult row to hoe trying to figure out how to raise their children, how to celebrate holidays, and find a path for themselves. I don't think I would be quick to dismiss people who are intermarried. The short answer to your question, try once more, is I think if Jews and Christians want to study Bible together, that should only be encouraged. That's hardly something to look askance at. The more Bible study, I think, the happier we are. Our differences will be clear quickly, and the fact that we can learn to listen to one another is a goal that serves not only both religions but our society at large.
But you think it's different in the home?
Well, I think home life has its own dynamic, and it's no secret that people have different behaviors at home than they do in public. And often tensions arise over religious issues that may not arise in the course of, say, Bible study in a public forum.
As we record this interview, you are about to get married. You're getting married in a few days. I'd love to hear what kind of ceremony you're planning.
Well, I'm marrying a Jewish woman from Long Island who is an attorney, and for me, the difficult question is, which rabbi do I ask to perform this ceremony, since virtually all of my friends are rabbis? But I have two dear friends, one of whom I worked with for many years when I was the associate dean of the graduate school at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the other of whom serves both as the rabbi of my synagogue and my Friday morning study partner. And they will be performing the marriage ceremony. It will be a mostly traditional Jewish ceremony, although the very traditional Jewish wedding contract will have a clause in it that's actually added from a 9th century manuscript, which gives the woman pretty much equal rights, which traditional Jewish marriage contracts don't always do.
Are you writing your own vows or anything? What do you think of that?
Jews are always pretty wary of vows, because vows tend to bring God in as an unwilling partner, and vows are too easily broken. But the marriage contract is the essence of it, and the marriage contract, which is in Aramaic, which, as it happens, is a language I know, is really Jewish marriage contracts are anti-nuptial agreements.
Anti-nuptial?
That's with an E.
Oh,
prenuptial agreements.
Prenuptial. I thought this is a pretty radical approach to the marriage license.
Guaranteeing to the woman, in what used to be a society where women had very little rights, guaranteeing to the woman in case of divorce or the death of her husband that she get a share of the estate. In my marriage contract, not only will I give all of those traditional guarantees to my soon-to-be wife, Sandy, but Sandy will, in her Aramaic portion, guarantee me certain things as well, and together we, I guess the word is vow, but we affirm that we will have a Jewish home where we respect one another and love one another and serve one another equally. And that little clause, feminist though it sounds, is from a 9th century document, a manuscript found in the old synagogue in Cairo.
So that 9th century document assumes the possibility of divorce.
All Jewish marriage contracts assume the possibility of divorce. The Torah itself, in the 5 books of Moses, women are guaranteed the right to a divorce document if their husbands want to leave them, and it's a divorce document that guarantees the women some financial capabilities.
So divorce isn't looked down on?
No. If you're in an unhappy home, I think divorce is a mitzvah. It's a commandment. You don't stay unhappy, you don't stay miserable, you don't torture one another, you don't torture your children, you start over. Human beings are imperfect and frail, and the Torah recognizes that.
Burton Vysotsky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a wonderful hour.
Rabbi Burton Vysotsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan. His new book is called The Genesis of Ethics. You can see him on Bill Moyer's PBS series on Genesis. The series was inspired by Vysotsky's Genesis seminars. This is Fresh Air.